In December of 1985, American naturalist Diane Fossey was murdered at the Karasoke Research Center in the mountains of Rwanda, Africa. She founded the center to study the mountain gorillas, but by the end of her life, she had virtually given up research to devote her full energy to protecting the gorillas against the threat of extinction. Fossey was controversial in the science world for getting too emotionally involved with the gorillas. In Rwanda, she was hated by many hunters because she ran patrols to prevent them from hurting the gorillas. 4 months after Fossey's murder, David Watts took over the direction of the Karasoke Center. It had previously been his home base for the 3 years he spent studying the mountain gorillas. Watts recently resigned and returned to the United States, where he's about to teach at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. But shortly before Watts left Africa, he became the intermediary between the mountain gorillas and Hollywood. Diane Fossey is the subject of a forthcoming feature film called Gorillas in the Mist, starring Sigourney Weaver as Fossey. Weaver, director Michael Apted, and the crew came to the Virunga Mountains to shoot on location. The gorillas Watts was studying became Sigourney Weaver's co-stars. I asked David Watts if he was enthusiastic when he first heard about the film.
No, before it happened, I wasn't pleased. I had a great sense of foreboding, partly for personal reasons having to do with the subject matter, but also I didn't like the idea of such a big project being done and of so many people being around the animals. The gorillas are very used to having humans around them, but we do interfere in their lives somewhat, and the more people there are around them, the more equipment, the more potential there is that they can really be bothered. And I had a few misgivings about what the long-term implications of a Hollywood film might be, but I also had misgivings about the possible immediate implications of having a film crew with a lot of equipment trying to work around the gorillas. I have worked with television documentary crews before, and there hadn't been any real problems, but these generally are people who make wildlife documentaries professionally. They aren't Hollywood studio people. And also, 35 millimeter equipment is a lot bigger than 16 millimeter equipment. And the Hollywood crew needed more backup equipment.
I can think of a big difference between a wildlife crew and a Hollywood crew, and that is the wildlife crew is going to just want to watch the animals doing what they do, whereas a narrative film crew is going to want the animals to behave in a way that fits with the storyline, that's congruent with the script.
Yeah, I tried, in corresponding with them before it happened, I tried to make it clear to them that they couldn't come with any expectations about what they were going to film the gorillas doing, that and in the end, they realized that they were simply going to have to work with whatever footage that they got and build their storyline around that rather than being able to direct the gorillas. And in the end, my misgivings weren't warranted. And a large part of the reason for that was that they hired a fellow named Simon Trevor, who is a Kenyan and is a wildlife cinematographer and a real African bush person, to be in charge of the unit that actually filmed the gorillas. So he was the perfect person for the job. He loves being around wild animals. He spent most of his life around wild animals and is more at home there than I am. So he had the required sensitivity and interest in the animals themselves. And everyone, all the humans, behaved themselves very appropriately. And there weren't any real problems around the gorillas.
So what was your job on the film?
My job was to be a consultant and also basically to be the ambassador to the gorillas. The Hollywood people wanted specifically to work with one of the research groups, Group 5. These were, quote-unquote, Diane's gorillas, and the names of many of them would be familiar to anyone who's read her book. And one of the reasons why they wanted to work, the main reason why they wanted to work with this group was that there is a tradition of actual physical contact between some of the gorillas in this group and humans. But they wanted to have that kind of contact between Sigourney Weaver and gorillas. They also wanted just to be able to get close to the gorillas and have the gorillas not very nervous with them around. And strangers can't do that on their own. They need to go with someone who is known by the gorillas.
What was the most important thing that you felt you had to communicate to the cameraman and the director when the movie was going to be shot about how to photograph the gorillas without intruding on their territory.
Do what I say, and pay attention to me because I know what I'm talking about. I was fairly confident that I could be aware enough of how the gorillas were responding to the situation that I could stop problems before they got out of hand, or see them coming and prevent them from coming up at all.
Were there any close calls where a gorilla got really angry at one of the crew or one of the actors because they did the wrong thing?
No, there weren't. There were a few moments when the gorillas were obviously annoyed or felt a little frightened, but nothing serious. There were a few close calls of a more playful sort where Maggie ran off with one of their lens cases one day. Maggie is the biggest thief in Group 5 and will steal anything that isn't strapped to you or nailed down. And Pablo is a now 13-year-old male who's very, very comfortable with humans and very big and strong and likes to do things like sit on you and pin you to the ground or grab you by the shoulder and drag you around, all in good fun.
Do you think that there's any connections between mountain gorilla behavior and human behavior? Does that interest you?
Yes, it interests me. It's more important initially to understand gorillas as gorillas, but there certainly is continuity, and the gorillas do have a lot to tell us about ourselves, I think. They do in two respects, one of which is that by better understanding the dynamics of the social behavior of gorillas or chimpanzees or baboons, we can hope to come up with a general understanding, what we might call the general laws of behavior. And it's a somewhat controversial question how far such laws might also apply to our own behavior, but I think they certainly do to some extent. On a kind of a more immediate level, it's interesting to look at such things as infant development in the gorillas or communication in the gorillas and make direct comparisons between their behavior and our own behavior. And some of that can be done in a very informal way. For example, when you spend time with the gorillas and are close to them and get to know them and then stop to think about it, you realize that there's an awful lot of communication that goes on between you without your even needing to stop and think about it, because it's the same as what we do with each other. And you're sending signals that you would to another person, and they respond to them, and you respond to their signals as you would to another human, and it all works fine.
Did you learn the sounds that gorillas use to communicate and learn their gestures as well so that you could send signals to them and understand what they were communicating to each other?
I wouldn't say that I have a complete understanding of all of their sounds. Some of them, yes, I learned, and some of them we make. I can't make all of them, but those that I could do, I would use. And partly as a matter of courtesy, and partly to smooth things and make it easier to be around them.
Courtesy to the gorillas?
Yeah.
It's like courteous to to say certain things to them, to communicate certain things to them when you're around them, you've intruded on their space?
Yeah. For example, there's a sound, what we call a belch vocalization, which is something like and they give that in a lot of contexts, but one is that if someone has been sitting quietly eating or just resting and decides to get up and move somewhere, they will often do that. And when I noticed that, I thought, well, if I'm sitting quietly and there's a gorilla near me who's got his or her back turned towards me, if I'm going to get up and move, before I move, I should do that. So it's a way of saying, I'm here and I'm about to do something. If you want to see what it is, you can pay attention to me so I don't startle them.
What are the sounds did you learn to make that were gorilla sounds?
Well, there's one that's like which is a mildly aggressive vocalization, which they do to me more often than I do to them, because I would always defer to them and not tell them I'm angry at you. I might sometimes do it to an infant who was trying to steal something from me, but I received that a lot more than I gave it. Those are basically the two that humans use frequently to communicate with the gorillas. There are others that the gorillas make, some of which I can't do myself anyway.
Did you practice those sounds before trying them out on the gorillas?
No, not really. I went out to see the gorillas not quite the first day that I was at Karasoki. I actually went out to look for poachers and saw a poacher before I ever saw a gorilla. But then the second day that I was there, I went out and was introduced to the gorillas and was immediately very close to them and got on-the-job training in vocalizations.
Yeah, you mentioned that you were close to the gorillas. Now, Diane Fossey, as you said before, used to say that she sometimes preferred gorillas to people, and I think that some people who study gorillas and monkeys have this close feeling toward them in a way that researchers studying animals, other animals, might not. Perhaps mm-hmm. because monkeys and gorillas remind us a little bit of ourselves. Did you find yourself getting really close to the mountain gorillas that you studied, getting really involved with their family life, caring about them individually a lot?
Oh, yes. In fact, when I'm there, they really become the center of my own emotional life. You become very close to them, very concerned with them, and you know them as individuals, and you get to know their personalities and their idiosyncrasies, and they're wonderful. And yet, you have to be aware at the same time that your relationships with them are very one-sided, that they're not going to be that interested in you, and they're not going to accept you as if you're another gorilla.
What's the greatest compliment a gorilla ever gave you?
Well, there have been so many. That would be hard to answer. Maybe there was a time about a year and a half ago when Tiger, who was a silverback male, had been very badly hurt in a fight with gorillas in another group. And there's now a program of veterinary management of the gorillas there. And some of what's been done in the way of caring for the gorillas is a little controversial. There might be people who would say that at least in some circumstances you shouldn't interfere and shouldn't try to treat them if they're sick or injured. In that case, I decided that he was almost certainly going to die if he wasn't treated medically. And in talking with other people there doing conservation work, decided that we should intervene. And we tried to do it initially by shooting antibiotics into him with a dart pistol, but it didn't work very well the first day. In the meantime, I had been... This was a gorilla who had grown up with humans around him for all of his life, and I had spent days and days and days with him, and he knew me really well, and he would permit me really close to him and was very calm, even friendly towards me. And he let me give him some food while he was sitting there so sick. And I suggested that I try feeding him medicine mixed up with the food. And it worked. He took food from me that had antibiotics on it, and I can't be certain that it saved his life, that he wouldn't have survived anyway, but he certainly picked up after that. And it was an incredible experience. But what was most complimentary to me in a way, but also made me feel very humble at the same time, was the way that he started to respond to me when I would approach him with food and offer it to him. And he really showed gratitude. It's something that was very subtle. It just was in his eyes and in his expression, the way he looked at me. But it clearly was saying thanks for helping me out. And my kind of silent response to that was, it's the least I could do for you after everything that you've, all the vicarious pleasure that you've given me. But to have that gratitude was really an enormous compliment.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your work in Rwanda with the mountain gorillas, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is David Watts, and he took over as director of the Karasoke Research Center in Rwanda, Africa, after the death of Diane Fossey in 1985. Watts had worked with Fossey for 3 years before she was murdered. He has left Rwanda for now and will be teaching at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor this fall. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. David Watts is my guest, and we're talking about the mountain gorilla, which he has researched, and he formerly headed the Karasoke Research Center in the Virunga Mountains of Africa. After Diane Fossey's murder, you took over the directing position of the Karasoke Research Center. Uh-huh. You had been in the United States at the time of her murder. You had already left the center, this is my understanding, but you were invited back to direct it. Did you want to go? Did you just say yes when you were asked?
No, I didn't immediately just say yes. I had just recently come back from a long stay there. I love being around the gorillas. I love the place. I have a lot of human friends there, too. But it's not the easiest thing in the world to do, to go off and live in such a socially deprived situation for long periods of time. And I had left in 1985, partly because I decided, well, it's enough for now. I want to go back and live with humans for a while. And I had been back in the human world for only a couple of months when Diane was killed. And I realized that I wasn't psychologically ready. Had it been other circumstances, I would have said, well, I want to spend some more time here before I go back into the field. I also realized that it was very important to go back there. I had a suspicion that if I didn't do it, that the place probably wouldn't continue. That's because there are only a few people who had a lot of familiarity with Karasoke and how it functioned in the first place, and the other people were committed to other things. And also, at that point, the Rwandan government would not have accepted someone they didn't already know, and they knew me, and were willing to say, yes, this person can come back. So I felt a very strong sense of obligation that I should go back. And once I got there, I didn't mind being there again. In fact, I was very happy to be there.
Was there a murder investigation in progress when you returned?
Yeah. I didn't get back until several months after she was killed. So by then, the investigation was well underway.
Did that make studying the gorillas difficult because there was an investigation going on around you?
Well, it didn't. By that time, it was no longer going on around us at the camp or in the park, and it didn't impinge on our daily existence there in any immediate way. So, no, it didn't make going out to study the gorillas difficult. In fact, you could have this sense of unreality being off with the gorillas. Sometimes it's as if nothing else exists, including murder investigations. In other ways, so it was something that always was there in the air and that we all were concerned about and was rather difficult to live with.
I should think you'd be kind of spooked by it as well as concerned about it.
Sometimes, yes, I must admit. And it was very tragic, but I also had decided immediately when I was thinking about going back there that I didn't face any personal danger, that whatever happened to Diane happened because she was Diane and because of the way she behaved, and I didn't think that I would have any enemies who would do that to me.
Now, Diane Fossey had basically given up research herself over the last few years of her life, and she was devoting virtually all of her efforts to protecting the mountain gorillas. When you took over the center, did you want to change the direction it was headed in?
No. In fact, not so far as the conservation role of the center went. No one ever wanted to stop doing the utmost that we could to protect the gorillas. And in fact, the government there allowed activities at the center to go on without interruption and allowed the anti-poaching work to continue. And it's really the government that does most of the anti-poaching work now anyway. It's park guards who are government employees. So in that sense, no, I didn't want to change anything that was going on. But I did want to try to integrate the research end of things more fully with other people there doing other aspects of the conservation work, just to make relationships a little more cooperative than they had been in the past. And I also hoped that the research would be expanded to include more than just gorillas, and to look at other animals in the park and other aspects of the ecology of the area.
About how many mountain gorillas are left now?
Well, there are two populations that were in the past one continuous population, but now are separated by cultivated land. In the Virunga volcanoes, there are about 300, and then in the impenetrable forest in Uganda, there are 200-some animals left, so the total is about 500, which is more than we thought a few years ago. In fact, we know that the Virunga's population has actually increased in recent years, thanks undoubtedly to the better efforts at protecting the animals, but it's still very few gorillas.
What are the greatest threats now to the survival of the mountain gorillas?
Well, the greatest immediate threat is poaching, and most of the poaching is not directed at the gorillas. In fact, we don't know of any deliberate gorilla killings for several years now, which is good, but there are people who use traditional methods still, or occasionally even automatic rifles, to go hunt other animals in the park, mostly antelope, which they trap for meat. And the gorillas can be caught in those traps and can die or be maimed as a result of infections that they get. And the level of poaching is down, but it still goes on every day. So it's necessary to keep on trying to keep the poachers out of the park, or at least to find their snares and cut them down before they catch anything. But the more serious long-term threat comes from the growth of the human population and the needs of the human population in that part of the world. And the real conservation problems there, even the poaching, are like conservation problems everywhere, basically socioeconomic problems. In this country, socioeconomic problems go on at a different level, the level of, say, corporate profits versus quality of the environment. But in Rwanda, it's much more starkly a question of meeting basic human subsistence needs. Are people going to have enough to eat? Are they going to have wood to cook with or to build their homes with? And the Rwanda has the highest population density in Africa, and a rapidly increasing population. And when you see the way that people are crowded already, it's difficult to be very optimistic about the gorillas' long-term prospects. But there have been a lot of very positive developments in recent years. The big question is, will people's lives there be improved sufficiently that they will be convinced that they can live without cutting down what's left of the gorilla's habitat? And that's the big threat to the gorillas, that they already have lost most of their habitat to humans, and they can't lose much more, and really they can't lose any more if we expect them to survive.
Well, hearing you talk, I can tell that you still really care about the gorillas that you studied when you were in Africa. And I can't help but wonder why you decided to leave and come back to the United States.
I do care about them. I miss them terribly, and I hope that I see them again before too long. But one important realization that I've had over the years of being here is that I'm not a gorilla. I mean, that sounds trivial, but it's not really. And
it took you a while to come to that realization.
Yeah, and I think anyone needs to spend, even someone who is able to spend long periods of time off in the field like that, needs to get away sometimes and to have another life in the world of humans, if only because eventually your job performance is going to go down if you just live off in the bush. I do have some obligations to come forth with the results of all the research that I've done there, and I reached a point where I needed to take a good space of time off and do some writing and data analysis, because I found that it was impossible to get that done in Rwanda. But I certainly hope to go back there sometime before too long.
Does it give you a good perspective to have lived a long time in a very remote area, living around gorillas? Do you feel that you can take things easier than you might have without that experience? That it gives you a different perspective?
Yeah, I think it gives one a different perspective in a lot of ways, if you're at all open to a lot of things. For one thing, seeing the way the humans live there has made a big difference to me and the way I look at the world. Also, spending so much time by myself with the gorillas has made me see the people in my life very differently, and see my relationships with them differently, and they've become much more important to me. And it also, living that kind of life, which is very simple in comparison to what so many people in this country are used to, does make you, in a way, more at ease with the world, maybe in some ways alienated from the world back here too, but content with a little less than you might be otherwise.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
David Watts became the director of the Karasoke Research Center in Rwanda, Africa, after the murder of Diane Fossey in 1985. He recently worked with the film crew that was in Rwanda to make a movie of Fossey's life. That film, Gorillas in the Mist, starring Sigourney Weaver as Fossey, is scheduled to open in September. David Watts has returned to the United States and will teach at the University of Michigan in the fall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.